Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mapping Murder: The Secrets of Geographical Profiling by David Cantor. Narrated by Matthew Lloyd Davis. Then begins a journey in my head. Shakespeare, Sonnet 27. A note on gender. Throughout the book, offenders are assumed to be male, and the victims are usually assumed to be women. This is because all the offenders I have considered here have been men, and the great majority of their victims have been women. As I discussed in Criminal Shadows 10 years ago, and has almost certainly been true since Cain and Abel, men commit the vast majority of violent offences. Men, of course, are also the victims of sexual assaults, and statistics show that young men especially are more likely to be the victims of violent crime than women. It is also the case that there are an increasing number of violent female offenders. However, the important matters raised by the existence of male victims of violence and by female murderers and sexual abusers are not dealt with in the present volume. 1. Hunting Killers. Travelling in from Kentucky, Ronald Lance pulled his truck into the McDonald's car park at the I-70 services just north of Washington, D.C. It was a little after midnight, so he was listening to his favourite radio show, The Truckin' Bozo. Unexpectedly, there was a news flash. The police were urgently looking for a blue Chevrolet Caprice, license plate NDA21Z. Glancing out of his truck window, to his surprise, he saw the car parked a few yards away. Ron was looking at the source of the most terrifying series of shootings that America has seen in recent times. For 21 days, people in the states around Washington, D.C. and in the capital itself had been avoiding leaving their homes. They had rushed from building to building, petrified at the possibility they might be the next unlucky person to pass unwittingly into the sniper's line of fire. 10 had already been killed, and a further 3 seriously wounded, each with a single shot. The frighteningly accurate snipers had paralyzed the heart of the nation, holding the world's media in thrall. Now Ron was sitting there, fully aware that he was just yards from the vehicle the police had at last traced as the one owned by the deadly killers. But the police had no idea they were looking for 2 killers. The Washington sniper killings, as they were dubbed by the press, were assumed to be the work of one man. Ron did not get the hell out, as many of us might. He called 911 and followed the instruction he was given. He moved his lorry to block the exit, then sat tight and waited for the police to arrive. Joined by the service area patrolman, Larry Blank, who was trying to find out what all the fuss was on his police scanner, the 2 men sat there for more than 2 hours, with mobiles as lifelines, blocking the escape route as police silently moved their troops into place. Finally, at 3 a.m., with choppers overhead and searchlights blazing, the SWAT team moved in, smashing the car windows and screaming instructions at the car's occupants to surrender. Woken from their sleep, bleary-eyed and bewildered, John Muhammad and John Lee Malvo offered no resistance. As one officer reported, they practically slept through the takedown. Although Chief Moose, the man leading the hunt, had known which car he was looking for a couple of days earlier, he was forced into calling a midnight press conference when the information leaked out. Less than an hour afterwards, Ron had told him where the car was. The Washington snipers, pursued for weeks by a military-style campaign, with roadblocks closing main routes and teams of surveillance helicopters searching from the air, were caught by the simple expedient of using the eyes of the public. Turning to the public was close to being a last resort, and even the potential value of that had been hotly debated amongst the many investigating teams. Every conceivable possibility had been considered for finding who was responsible for the apparently random killings. The Map of Murder. The two men woken in their blue Chevrolet were John Muhammad, a 41-year-old Gulf War veteran and winner of marksmanship awards, and 17-year-old John Lee Malvo, an illegal immigrant from Jamaica, whom Muhammad habitually introduced as his stepson. They had terrorized a 100-mile area in Maryland and Virginia around Washington, D.C., shooting whoever came into their sights. They had begun by killing 7 people in Montgomery County before roaming along Interstates 50 and 95, wounding 3 and killing another 3 along the way. The victims had all been killed from a distance with a single rifle shot, the killers disappearing without a trace in the ensuing confusion. The unpredictability and apparent senselessness of the shootings caused immense fear and chaos. Parks were empty. Schools operated under Code Blue, which bans any outdoor activity. There was traffic gridlock. It was the lack of any obvious rationale to the crimes, mixed with the deadly rifle accuracy and the size of the killing area around the American capital, that caused such consternation and media interest. At its height, 1,400 journalists were living in tents outside the investigation headquarters at Rockville Police Station in Maryland, producing saturation television coverage. Some 24-hour cable channels had record viewing figures for the year. To call these shootings serial killings was to put them seriously in the same category as those of the killers who prey on vulnerable underdogs, seeking out victims in the twilight zones of cities. Their victims usually have something in common, even if only their availability and weakness. The public panic and media fascination with the sniper was driven by the feeling that the shootings might be arbitrary. It quickly became clear that the victims shared nothing. They were not all immigrant men, as had been the case in Stockholm in 1992, when 10 people were picked off with a laser-sighted rifle in a racist shooting spree. Those victims around Washington came from a wide mix of ethnic backgrounds. There were men and women amongst the dead, as there were young and old, school children and adults. Neither was there a clearly focused target, as there had been in the dreadful school shooting in Columbine in 1999, or the murder of 21 people by a security guard in a San Isidro McDonald's in 1984. Those victims had been unfortunate in being in a place that had a special significance for the spree killers. But the place for the Washington snipers was the whole area circumscribed by the interstates and beltway around Washington. The killings spread out from Silver Spring, close to the heart of the capital, all the way to Ashland, just north of Richmond, Virginia. This map of the dead and wounded cries out for interpretation. It is trying to tell us the personal narrative of the killers. Does it reveal a deadly vendetta against some abstract institution, as some insisted? Or is it a reflection of a sadistic urge to kill and kill again? Was it perhaps more of a deadly adventure acted out for excitement? Or could it have been a form of suicide, murdering others as a step towards their own tragic deaths? The map of these killings, like the maps of any other violent crimes, captures a journey in space and time. Not just travels to find victims, but an inner journey the offender is taking, learning what excites them, the roles he can play, how to go beyond the limits. The personal voyage is both a creation for the murderer and a journey of self-discovery. The map hints at the travels across this private landscape. If only we can fathom how to unravel those hints. The experts move in. We live in a world where expertise is the substitute for considered discussion. When faced with a difficult problem, such as what the Washington sniper killings were all about, content producers for newspapers, radio and television fill the vacuum in understanding by quoting anyone who claims some special expertise. There is the belief, held fondly by the public at large, although I suspect not by journalists, who are filling column inches and broadcast time to tight deadlines, that anyone who claims special expertise has some profound basis for their opinion, one that is not available to the public at large. Yet as Marymount University's Professor of Forensic Psychology, Mary Lindahl, said with some ferocity after the glut of expert opinions offered during the search for the Washington sniper, the public could profile as well as the experts on TV. Most were wrong. Indeed, some have suggested that the attempts to stop the tragic and unnecessary deaths of so many people around Washington may have been weakened by the outpourings of experts of every ilk. The range of opinions offered was staggering. Some thought it was the work of Al-Qaeda operatives. Others considered it a homage to the Son of Sam murders, to mark their 25-year anniversary. An even more exotic suggestion was that it was a reenactment of a storyline in the television program Homicide. Computer nerds, addicted to shoot-'em-up video games, were also blamed. And inevitably, the devil got in on the act. "This has something to do with a satanic ritual," said holistic advisor Zorrell. "If you look at the map and connect the dots, it looks like a cross upside down. But people aren't realizing it, not even the police." Beyond these vacuous speculations were those that came from people who claimed to make a profession of giving advice to the police. That curious group of specialists who were graced with the label of profiler. They agreed with unusual unanimity that the sniper was white, although the reason for this assertion was far from clear. When you break down the demographics of the Washington region, there is a statistical probability that the sniper is a white man, Greg McCrary, a retired FBI profiler, told the Washington Post. Was McCrary therefore saying that the sniper was a typical Washington resident? Brian Levin, director of California State University's Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, revealed something of his own prejudices when he said, "It's a kind of a wallpaper white male, a disenfranchised, disrespected man who's getting back at society." Chris Whitcomb, a former FBI agent, backed up his misguided speculation by claiming a numerical basis for his opinion when he informed NBC that, statistically, it's going to be a white male. But which sample or study Whitcomb was drawing on was never indicated. Even a casual search of the internet shows that black serial killers are not unusual. And who is to say that a sniper roaming the interstates has to have similarities to the serial killers on the FBI casebooks? One sniper came from Alabama, the other from Jamaica. Neither would pass for white under any lighting conditions. Other predictions were no more accurate. Dr. Michael Wellner from New York University declared the sniper to be single, 20s to 30s. This presumably drew on the typical characteristics of most murderers who attack strangers. Should this have been the reference group for such an unparalleled campaign? Mohammed was in his 40s and had been twice married. Malvo was a teenager. One person who is apparently always ready to offer up detailed profiles of cases, Brent Turvey, told the Washington Times that the killer was so exact in the attacks that he was unlikely to contact police or give away any evidence that would help the investigation. But in the end, the snipers were located because they could not resist bragging about their involvement in an earlier Alabama robbery shooting, providing the clues that eventually led to their arrest. So it was a good job the police ignored Turvey's confident advice. Unfortunately, many people mistakenly believe these varied opinions to be derived from the detailed analysis of hundreds, if not thousands, of cases, building up common trends in true scientific fashion. It was therefore wrongly assumed that their obvious inaccuracy was a failure of science and of the statistics on which many scientific conclusions are based. Criminal profilers may be the logical outgrowths of a society that believes all of human reality can be quantified. A touching faith in the truth-revealing ability of statistical analysis, wrote the Washington Post dismissively. These various profiles are problematic not because of the weakness of science, but because of their own scientific weakness. Some claimed the suggestions had been based on statistics. But how could there be general trends or statistics for a set of killings so unusual? And even if there had been, statistics do not make science. Knowing how many women have thought about killing their partners, or how many men have been unfaithful, frequencies, percentages, statistics, may be a small step towards a scientific understanding of jealousy, but it is a very small step indeed. It does not explain how cheating husbands emerge, and nor does it predict which wives will follow through on their musings and kill. The Secret of Geographical Profiling. Science always has two components, explanation and prediction. Explanation alone drifts into arid philosophizing. Prediction without understanding can be useful, but soon becomes mechanical and barren. Most of what we think of as the progress of technology, the development of civilization, has come from the interplay between explanation and prediction. For profiling to become a science, we need to expand our understanding of criminals and to test that against calculations of what they will do. Understanding is not full-born in a mature state. It starts with speculation, often derived from observations. Many of the suggestions about the sniper are best considered as pre-scientific rather than unscientific. They are early attempts with little information to sketch out basic theories. Unfortunately, the media want hard and fast findings, and many people are prepared to present their conjectures as just that. For guesses to develop into theories, they need clear contact with some form of fact. These facts are derived from the rigorous observation at the heart of science. The more such observation leads us to objective facts, the more fertile will be the ground in which theories will develop into explanations. In 1985, I was called on to help the police locate a serial killer and rapist. I had to speculate in the absence of any accumulation of systematic knowledge about or understanding of such criminals. I had to do the best I could with the information and theories available. I found that the unexpected success of my contribution relied heavily on my study of where the crimes had occurred. The use of crime locations to understand the offender and propose where he might be living is today known as geographical profiling. Since that time, I have followed up those initial effective conjectures with many studies. These studies have shown not only that my early ideas were reasonably sound, but even more importantly, that other scientists were productively following similar tracks. I put the reason for this success, at least in part, down to the fact that the most objective and observable aspect of any crime is where it happens. One of the most interesting suggestions about the sniper offered by experts, therefore, was that he was living in Montgomery County. A red zone area in the county was identified by profilers as probably containing the sniper's home, and this was used by the investigation task force. This proposal was based on the map that pinpointed the locations of the shootings, but as it turned out, this suggestion was wrong as well. The snipers had been living for weeks in the car in which they were caught. At one point they had even been moved on by police who thought they were just vagrants when one of them was found sleeping in their car. But as we shall see, The reason it was wrong was not a failure of statistics or mathematics. It was a failure to understand and explain the geographical distribution of the offences and to fathom the personal narrative they tell of the killer. The secret of geographical profiling is to go beyond the dots on the map to understand the significance of the places the offender is choosing and the meaning to him of the journey he is making. There is always a choice available to any offender of where to offend. That choice comes from within his criminal being, and understanding how that choice is made opens doors into the criminal's mind. Zorrell may not have been right to see a satanic influence in the shape of the sniper's dots on the map, but she was pointing in the right direction when she proposed looking at what the pattern of locations meant. The people shot dead around Washington by the snipers had nothing in common with each other. They were not being selected because of their particular characteristics. As with so many of the victims we shall be considering, we have to ask, why are they falling prey? The answer has to be not who they are, but where they are. Criminals always have some choice in where they commit their crimes. Many different processes will influence the decision they make about their crime location. But these processes all come together in the place where the crime occurs. Places are never without significance. Our lives are scratched into the surface of the earth's crust. Scratches that tell our personal history as much as our social history. Sometimes the marks are left by human actions, such as murders or other violent crimes. The marks left by these killers needs to be interpreted. We need to look not just at what they are, but why they are in that particular location. The locations themselves are part of the journeys the criminals are making. It is these journeys and the places that define them that we shall be exploring. Criminal journeys. The journey of the Washington snipers spread out over a wide swathe, touching three states. It started in an almost casual way on 2 October 2002. The first shots were fired at the window of a craft store in Aspen Hill. No one was hurt. But later the same day, a few miles away in Silver Spring, a man was shot dead in a car park. The determination behind the attacks became clear the next day. In a series of incidents distributed around Montgomery County, five people were each killed with a single shot when they were going about their daily activities, outside a post office, at a petrol station, or in other public places. None of the shootings were more than 5 miles apart, except for the last that day, as the killers moved south to the edge of the District of Columbia on the very doorstep of Washington itself. From there, the shootings spread ever further afield along the interstate highways, with the furthest over 100 miles away in Virginia. These men were not picking off victims days or weeks apart in the pattern typical of many serial killers. They had not lured people into their car to rape and kill, then dispose of the bodies along their journey. Although a rifle was their chosen weapon, their actions were very different from those of Charles Whitman, who took a 12-gauge shotgun up the 307-foot-high clock tower at the University of Texas in 1966, shooting at anyone who came into his sights and killing 16 people. Muhammad and Malvo's spree of killing involved careful, fatal precision, using the cover provided by the tree-lined suburbs of Washington. We all have a particular style of dealing with the world, and serial criminals are no different. Their distinct characters are embedded in how, where, and when they commit their crimes. But most particularly where. It is these consistencies of place that start us on our journey to understand and predict criminals' violent actions. Criminal journeys are more than just movements through time and space. Each step that makes up the overall picture betrays some intention. From the purposeful exploration of the opportunity to offend, taking some account of the risks involved, although this is often a remarkably limited assessment, to the actual task of committing the crime. Offenders' journeys have two surprising features, pointers to their criminal nature, that have been found over and over again in studies of serial offenders. One is the way in which the home, or at least where criminals are based, acts as a focus for their actions. The other is the geographical scale over which they operate. The base of a criminal is usually his home, but as we shall see, this can take various forms, and maybe the home in which he grew up rather than the house in which he is currently living. It acts as an anchor for his floating world, allowing him to sally out and return with confidence. It can become a haven or even a den into which he brings his victims. In some cases, it is a moving location, even a vehicle, such as that used by Mohammed and Malvo. The base and the role it plays in the life of the criminal helps shape the scale of his activities, from those who are very local, seeking opportunities for crime within walking distance of where they live, through those who travel much further afield, 10 or 20 miles, and on into a third group for whom travelling is the essence of their criminal style, and who may cover hundreds of miles. When it is considered that criminals can, in a simple sense, choose anywhere to offend, it is remarkable that so many studies that have sought to classify serial killers and rapists have found that the main differences between them are reflected in the size of the geographical range over which they operate. It is noteworthy, as we shall see, that the serial killer Fred West did not pick up any one of his victims more than a few miles from his base in Gloucester. Perhaps the most notorious serial killer of all time, Jack the Ripper, is known as the Whitechapel murderer because of the very limited area, a few minutes' walk in any direction, that contains the sites where he found and dispatched his victims. By contrast, Marc Dutroux is characterized by having abducted young girls from the four corners of Belgium. John Duffy, known as the railway rapist and murderer, who brought me into this dark world of violence, had a more subtle but no less distinct geographical pattern spreading out from the Kilburn area of North London. He eventually killed at the points of a triangle, each 30 miles away. It is these maps of murder that are the most distinct footprints of these criminals, just as the literal shoe print can tell us something about the height and build of the person who left it and, with a bit of extrapolation from shoe type, may hint at the lifestyle of the wearer. The metaphorical footprint on a map that captures the criminal's characteristic spatial pattern of offending reflects rather more of his makeup than is immediately apparent. It shows something of the psychological drama the criminal is living and relates directly to the way he deals with his victims. This is a fascinating discovery, that serial killers and rapists are not random or arbitrary in their actions. They have a recognizable mode of acting on the world around them, which includes how they find their victims and what they do to them. A form is given to their journeys by this consistency. But what creates such a dependable pattern of activity? In essence, it comes from each offender himself. The opportunities for crime, where there are possible victims or ready access and escape, will of course shape the pattern of offence behaviour. If an offender's predilections are for a particular type of victim, then he will be drawn to locations in which those sorts of people are available. Examples that are looked at in later chapters include the prostitutes that Sutcliffe killed, the defenceless young women and girls that Thompson sought, and the vulnerable women on the street that became the focus of attention for Garrett Young. The snipers found the wide highways of Maryland and Virginia ideal hunting grounds. Their closeness to the capital gave their actions an added excitement and a media presence that they clearly enjoyed. They did not seek or want any contact with their victims, who were just ciphers, exciting targets to be shot at. the snipers told the police that the shootings were about more than violence, but were never able to elaborate on what that extra...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?